Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi everybody, it's Jason here. This episode was recorded a few weeks ago, and since then we've had the sad news of the passing of Zach Nielsen, Harry's son, who was a great guy who really worked hard on his father's legacy and interacted with all of Harry's fans online. And so we'd like to dedicate this episode to him. Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. The legend goes that when John and Paul were in the USA in May 1968 doing press for the launch of Apple, they were asked who their favourite group was, and both of them said Nielsen. Harry Edward Nielsen III was born, as his own song states, in 1941. He was a unique songwriter, however his biggest hits were covers. He was a garrulous friend to musicians, but he never managed to play a live tour. And he had a singular career which wound in and out of the Beatle universe. So it's kind of hard to know where to start, really, isn't it, Stephen?
Yes, I mean, Harry Nielsen is a figure in his own right, but he also looms large in the legend of virtually every rock star, particularly in the early 70s, that L.A., crowd that the Beatles then ended up hanging with, Ringo and George in particular.
Yeah, and there's plenty of times, like, I don't think there's a Beatle biography that you can pick up, or even a solo Beatle biography, where Harry doesn't sort of pop up from time to time and, you know, is doing something exciting.
He's doing something interesting, certainly. Yes, I mean, he's a foil at some stage. He's a foil for, you know, George, Ringo, and particularly John, but Paul less so in the later years. He's very inextricably linked. I mean, he described himself at one stage as the potential fifth Beatle in a kind of mocking way.
Yes, and I think Derek Taylor also called him the American Beatle, which is an interesting thing to keep in the back of your mind. You know,
yeah.
But he has a certain there's a certain anglophilic nature to his music, I would say. But he's what we're going to try and do today is we're going to try and, you know, do two things at once, which is kind of an overview of the arc of Harry's career, but also, because we're a Beatles podcast, is to plug into the Beatles story where necessary to give a bit of context as to why Harry is there in the first place when we do read these biographies. He's as we kind of said in the intro there, he's a multi-talented man, Harry, isn't he? There's many things that he managed to get done in his career.
He is. I mean, I suppose the first thing to talk about is his voice. I mean, he just, particularly in the early years, he has an incredible voice, an incredible range. And you add to that, he's also just a really top flight songwriter. He's a vocal arranger. You think about the vocal parts he put together, particularly on the Ringo album or the Goodnight Vienna album. He's somebody that really has all of those talents in one package. But he always seems to be on the sidelines. He's always hanging out with the stars, but he never really has that sort of big breakthrough, I suppose.
So let's have a little look at the road, because before Harry gets involved with the Beatles themselves, there's, you know, his pre-professional and professional career on the road to that. So before that sort of May 1968 crowning from John and Paul, which kind of really does divert the spotlight onto Nielsen, and, you know, so much so that it's still worth talking about all these years later. But Harry was born in 1941, and he's doing a number of jobs to try and figure out a way into the music business in the 60s. And what's amusing is that his first step, or the first thing we know him for in the music business, is a Beatle-related effort in 1964.
Yes, we've talked about this on the songs about the Beatles written by other people.
Artists, I think the title was longer than that, maybe, I don't know.
This is sort of 1964. It's a song called All for the Beatles. It's one of those novelty tracks that sort of cash in. Stand Up and Holler was the alternative title. And I think it was the Photo 5-4. It doesn't roll off the tongue. there were four-part vocals, all recorded by Harry. So this is indicative of the way his career would go in terms of overdubbing and harmonizing with himself and doing these kind of arrangements. I've never seen a copy of this, but it came with a little piece of 8mm film, which was clips of the Beatles from February 64. And supposedly you could play the film and play the record and it would all sync up. I don't know if that's actually true.
Yeah, it's a pretty high-flying concept for a 1964 novelty single that you'd be playing movies and music together.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, you know, you buy the single, you never play the movie. That's who's going to play the movie? It's sort of, what, 3 minutes long? You're going to get the projector out, get the screen out, sync it up.
Get the family around. But you're right there. You can't overstate, though, his, you know, that there's a thread that runs through Nilsson, particularly in his core early 70s work, which is that he's a great kind of studio marvel, that he's great at multitracking, he's great at overdubbing himself, so much so that you almost don't notice it in the records. You know, it seems very straightforward and easy, but it's actually his records, when you start to zoom in on it, have an awful lot of technical smart stuff going on.
That's absolutely right. It's very subtle. It's very sophisticated. And, you know, you have to remember, this is sort of the early days, you know, 1964, this is early days of that type of sort of close harmony overdubbing. The Beatles are sort of exploring this at the same time with George Martin, but this becomes the hallmark of Harry's career, and to say his vocal arrangements for his own records and other people's records are stunning.
Yeah, there's a little bit of kind of Beatle double tracking going on at that time, which is kind of seen as a novelty when they're joining in on a line or two. But, you know, Harry is kind of working along the fringes. He does do a soundtrack in the 60s as well, but his main day job is working in a bank, and he's working in a bank when he gets his main break, which allows him to quit his job, which is he gets a song recorded by the Monkees, which is a bit of a payday for him, where he's able to leave. And that song is Cuddly Toy from the Monkees album Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn and Jones Limited. Shall we do an hour on the Monkees, Stephen?
Well, I think you could do an hour on the Monkees.
Here we go. No, but it was, it's again, though, Cuddly Toy is probably a song where, you know, Harry's name appears, you know, on the album sleeve as a writer. That name goes into millions of homes. It earns him a decent payday, enough to quit his job. And Cuddly Toy, despite its name, it's actually not really a nice, like, it's a good song, it's catchy and all the rest, but when you start to look at its layers, it's kind of unpleasant.
It's very unpleasant. Would I be right in saying it's the most subversive thing the Monkees ever recorded?
There's a couple of things. That album also has Star Collector on it, which is a song about, like, a really dismissive, horrible song about groupies. And there's lots of stuff going on in 67 Monkees, there's lots of stuff that's just really kind of mean. Like, even a song like She and all this kind of stuff, you know, some people would say they're misogynistic. And, you know, certainly with our 21st century lens, there are certain types of attitudes in these songs. Certainly the Cuddly Toy song seems to be, to use a modern term, could I say, slut shaming?
Yes. I mean, it's a very misogynistic song, but it's also that very dark sense of humor.
Yes,
that really comes out. And it's you double down on that by having a group like the Monkees record it. I mean, I know they were kind of trying to break away from but it's early in their career for them to be recording something like that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great, it is a very catchy song. And it's, as you say, if you want to take it with a po-facedness, you can say this isn't right. But actually, the thing to remember about Harry is he is funny. And this song, Cuddly Toy, comes out on the Monkees album in November 67. And his first big break commercial album was the album Pandemonium Shadow Show, which is hard to say. Even on the album itself, the announcer finds it hard to say. And this comes out a month later in December 1967. And so obviously Nielsen and the Monkees shared a record label RCA, which would have made it easy for pre-release copies to have circulated. And I think it might have been Nesmith who was the person who drew Harry into the, or maybe it was Dolenz who drew Harry into the Monkees orbit. But Pandemonium Shadow Show comes out so hard.
Well, we're going to have to move on quickly.
But it's Pandemonium Shadow Show has Beatles material on it. And what's interesting is it has a very straightforward cover of She's Leaving Home, which if you look at the record notes is only a week or two after Pepper comes out that he records that.
Yes, about 10 days later. And it's a fairly straight arrangement, but you think you can hear in the string arrangement and the sort of the melodicism of that song and also the subject matter. I think all of the things, it sort of, I guess this ticked a lot of boxes for Harry.
Well, Harry's, you know, you look at Harry's songs and, you know, there's an awful lot of songs about being abandoned or being lonely or solitude, you know, songs like 1941 and songs like Daddy's Song. So She's Leaving Home would fit into the Nielsen repertoire. Yeah. And it's recorded in June 67. And it's worth flagging, it's probably an obvious thing to say, but Harry is a huge Beatles fan. This is the thread that runs all through this. He is a massive yes. fan of the Beatles and just thinks they are the ultimate, the untoppables.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, he hasn't met them. He has no sort of, you know, entry into their orbit at this point. He's just a huge fan. Yeah, absolutely.
But the other track on, I have to say it again now, Pandemonium Shadow Show, that is perhaps more significant, is a song that's called You Can't Do That. And it's not really a straightforward cover of the Hard Day's Night track, You Can't Do That, even though it does hang itself on that. It's something else, isn't it?
It's something else entirely. It's like the first mashup, you know? So the idea here is he talks about this himself, and he said, he was playing with his guitar, and this is a bit of a sideswipe. He said, I struck a chord and I thought, that lends itself to a million different songs. And I noticed how many Beatles songs could be played on this one chord. So I ran down to the music store, got a Beatles songbook and finished the song that night. So what he does here is he just sings and overlays the vocal lines from, I don't know, is it about a dozen, 15 songs?
I've written it out. It's 2 minutes, 20 seconds long. And as I said, it's based on You Can't Do That, but it quotes, She's a Woman is the first song he quotes. Then I'm Down, Drive My Car, You're Gonna Lose That Girl, Good Day Sunshine, Hard Day's Night, Rain, I Wanna Hold Your Hand, Day Tripper, Paperback Writer, Do You Want to Know a Secret, Yesterday, and right at the end he interpolates Strawberry Fields Forever, so it brings it right up to 1967. So he's weaving all of these refrains and melody lines into a version of You Can't Do That.
And he's saying he arranged that in one evening. That was one evening's work.
Yeah, very natural for him. And what I like about it is, you know, it's very skillful, you know, for a guy essentially, you know, working on his own with a producer. And it doubles as a tribute to the Beatles. I know the Beatles so well, inside out, you know, I know the catalog that I can do something like this. But it's also, you could argue, slightly mocking. It's not a tribute with any kind of reverence. It's really a bit of a lark.
It is. It's that point where he says, you know, I realized how many songs by the Beatles could be played on one chord. And there is a slightly mocking tone to it. But at the same time, You can't help, even if you're a Beatles fan, you can't help but enjoy it for what it is.
Oh, it absolutely puts a big smile on your face. And it is this album that is the thing that pushes Nielsen into the Beatles consciousness. And it seems to be through Derek Taylor, who I guess is the first port that it goes through. And, you know, maybe if these Beatles songs weren't on the album, Derek wouldn't have noticed it. But you can imagine Derek hearing You Can't Do That and saying, oh, I have to get this to the bosses.
You think that must be the song that was the hook. So supposedly Derek buys an entire crate box of these albums. I'm not going to try and pronounce the title.
Go on.
Pandemonium Shadow Show.
There you go.
He buys a copy of that album and then buys a crate of that album. And he starts handing it out to friends. And as you say, he sends it over to London, sends it back to the bosses who are, you know, in the middle of selling up Apple, and saying, this is something you have to listen to. And you've got to imagine it it was that song that was the hook. Yeah.
And so before that sort of May 68 press conference, when John and Paul kind of crown him the greatest thing in the world, there's a couple of interactions with the Beatles. We think George is the first Beatle he meets in LA.
George is in LA. This is in August of 67.
It's that early, is it?
It's that early. He's on the rented house in Blue Jay Way.
Okay.
And Derek Taylor brings Harry to meet him. And Harry brings a rough cut of his next album, which is Aerial Ballet. You know, they get on famously, and Harry says he described George as being in a white windblown robe with a beard and long hair, looking like Christ with a camcorder. That's, you know, it's like,
okay.
And he recalled that George had heard the album and was very complimentary, and they hung out and smoked a little reefer and had a good time.
And then in early 68, you know, once the album is out and it reaches Lennon and McCartney and everyone else, they ring Harry, don't they?
They get in touch. Yeah, this is a very funny sort of sequence. So apparently, John, after binge listening to the album just constantly for, you know, a day or two, he rang up and Harry saying, you know, I was asleep. A voice called and said, "This is John. You're too much. You're great. We should get together and do something." And he was going, "Who is this?" He said, "Oh, it's John Lennon." He's going, "Yeah, right." He said, "No, it's John. I just wanted, you know, to tell you how great you were. Go back to sleep. Have a great day." And that was it. And then the next week, that was on a Monday, and the following Monday, Paul rings and said, "Hello, Harry, this is Paul. Just want to say you were great and, yeah, fantastic. John gave me the album. Looking forward to meeting you." And in the biography, his biographer says Harry got up the next Monday, you know, got dressed and sat waiting for the 4 o'clock in the morning call from Ringo, but it never came.
It
never came.
There'd be plenty of future calls from Ringo, though.
The Beatles are then individually ringing him and say, "Yeah, love this record." And you think, could it have gone the other way? Could they have heard "You Can't Do That" and thought,
"This guy's a smart aleck"? Well, there's a thing, I think we've touched on it once or twice before, where the Beatles had a different type of respect or acknowledgement of US artists than they did for UK artists. And so particularly on the London scene, it wasn't that they were unfriendly to other acts. You know, we knew they hung out with The Who and the Rolling Stones socially and all the rest, but they were never particularly open about promoting their records or, you know, saying, "Oh, this is great," or "Look at this." Whereas for American acts, yeah, they were a little bit more, you know, they would talk about the soul and Motown loves, and, you know, they big up Harry, which they're doing here. They big up to the Monkees, as I mentioned before. They didn't, I think the Atlantic was enough of a break for them to feel a little less threatened.
It could be. And I mean, I suppose there's always that thing that America in those days, you know, that was the origins of rock and roll. It was Elvis, it was Little Richard, it was Jerry Lee Lewis, it was Carl Perkins. This is the land of that delivered the music to their doors, sort of thing. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, they do
take it that way. And so when they eventually land on American soil and they're there on the 14th of May, 1968, they do a press conference in New York announcing the formation of Apple Corps. And Lennon is asked to name his favorite American artist. And he says, "Harry Nilsson, it's Nilsson." And McCartney says the same thing. And later on, they also claim that, you know, Nilsson for president. They're really ringing the Nilsson bell. And they don't, what's sweet about it is there's nothing in it for them to say that. No. It's not like he's coming on the Apple label, or even though that was mooted at one point. But
It's a genuine enthusiasm. They're not. There's no side to this. There isn't any kind of financial aspect to it. There's no publicity, no promotion in it for them. No, it's genuine love of the guy and the product.
And so, not long after, you know, Lennon and McCartney finished their U.S. Apple publicity jaunt, that Derek Taylor summons Harry over to London. And so Harry says, "All of a sudden, I was the fab blonde Beatle from the USA and a man of mystique," he remembered later. Invited to fly to England to attend the recording of the White Album, he went to the offices of Apple and found office workers wearing badges saying, "Harry is here," which is very sweet.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, part of my paranoia told me that this was all a joke, said Harry. But it kind of leads into the next phase of Harry versus the Beatles, which is when he gets inside their lives. And he gets introduced pretty quickly for a group who can be kind of cold.
Yes, maybe it's indicative of the kind of Apple years and the kind of accessibility where they were encouraging people. But because he had caught the ear of Derek Taylor, I suppose, he's just, he gets right into that inner circle. You imagine most people calling at Apple don't get past the lovely green carpeted reception. But Harry, you know, is already in there with Derek Taylor. He's already met George, and suddenly he's hanging out with them socially. He's in the studio. They're playing him demo tapes. Yeah. And as you say, there was this, if he hadn't been signed to RCA, he undoubtedly would have ended up on the Apple label.
Yeah. Now, over the years that follow, Harry becomes maybe most synonymous with Ringo and John. But before we get to that point, we might kind of look at, you know, Harry with George and Paul over the years, because those interactions are maybe a little bit less involved. And that's probably because George and Paul stayed based in the UK across the late 60s and early 70s, and John and Ringo gradually moved over to the US.
I think that's absolutely right. Because George, in particular, seemed to share that sort of dark sense of humor, and you know, he played on a number of Harry records. He dated Harry's ex-girlfriend for a time. It was the seventies. It was the seventies. But he played on a number of songs that Harry did, most notably You're Breaking My Heart, you know, that song.
You're going to read the lyrics to that one, Stephen?
No, I'm not going to read the lyrics to that. But we can put up a YouTube link, and anybody who's over 18 can link to that. But it's a kind of breakup song.
Yep.
About separation from his wife. It's got a very catchy chorus that you couldn't play on the radio, but it's the usual kind of crew. And this, we touched on this again before, particularly in the 74 episode. You have Bobby Keys, Jim Price, Klaus Voormann, Peter Frampton, Nicky Hopkins. All of these guys are part of that crew that are recording with the Beatles on Beatles solo albums at this time. And Harry, of course, wants this out as a single.
Yes.
And, you know, his record company aren't even keen on putting it on the
Well, we should, you know, maybe be a little less coy and say that the refrain is F you, you know, you're breaking my heart. So, you know, that's you know, it's like, it's not like Paul's for you many years later. It's a totally different word altogether.
It's a totally different word altogether.
And, you know, it's still a bit of an eyebrow raiser in the early 70s to hear the you know, a four letter expletive like that, but particularly in a song that's quite jolly and catchy a straightforward song. And that's the Harry dark humor again.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. You have a lovely catchy song. It's, you know, you're breaking my heart. You know, would you expect that next line to be, will you please come back to me, or don't leave me this way? Or, but no, it's F you. So,
yes. But it's, it's guaranteed to pop up on some of Harry's greatest hits without a parental advisory sticker. But one of the interesting Harry George overlaps is the song That Is All, which is not the most obvious lift. And, you know, as I said at the start, the thread that runs through all of this is that Harry is a Beatles super fan. He is paying attention to what they are releasing and what they are putting out. And, you know, kind of later on in his 70s career, in 76, Harry covers the track That Is All, which is from Living in the Material World.
It is. It's the last track on that album. It's a beautiful song, but it's not a song, I would think, you know, unless you were a sort of fan of deep cuts, you're not going to know this track. And I have to say, I like George's version, but I really love Harry's version. I think the arrangement that he does is just sublime.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, on Living in the Material World, it's the closing track of side two. And, you know, I'm not having a dig at George, but, you know, I think sometimes his songs do sound better when somebody else sings them.
And I can't disagree with that. I mean, I think a lot of that album's Living in the Material World, we now talk for an hour about Living in the Material World.
That's fine.
A lot of issues with George's albums are frequently the sequencing.
Yeah.
You know, he records the songs, and I think sometimes the sequencing lets it down. And this is not an album closer, really, in the way that George delivers it. I don't think it's not going to get noticed the way George does it and like where he places it.
Like the other track I'm thinking of from Living in the Material World is Try Some Buy Some, and you have Ronnie Spector's version, which is a great version as well. And I sometimes, and here I go, George, I sometimes feel that he One of the reasons I regularly big up the early Takes album is that George's vocals are kind of unthought. They're very natural. They're very, you know, spontaneous. Yeah. And sometimes I think he kind of gets into a studio voice and it doesn't lift the song. But that is all when I, you know, when I went back to listen to Harry's version, because I hadn't listened to that album, That's the Way It Is, for a while. That's the Harry album it's from 1976. I was like, oh, this is a superb take. And he uses it to, interestingly, to bookend the album. It opens the album and then there's a refrain right at the end of the album. So it's obviously a song that meant a lot to him.
It is, yes. I mean, it's as I say, I don't think it works as a closing song on George's album, but I think it works perfectly the way Harry does it.
And it also got covered by Andy Williams,
the fifth Beatle,
the real fifth Beatle.
Yeah. I hadn't realized this, but Andy Williams recorded this song, and interestingly, he used that same group of people
session
to do it.
Right.
Yeah, like Klaus Voormann, Nicky Hopkins, Jim Keltner. Was produced by Richard Perry. So this was, you know, just after or in between Living in the Material World and the Ringo album. So I think Andy Williams on that basis, you know, deserves a shout out. Have you ever seen Andy Williams in concert?
I have not. You're going to tell me you have?
I saw Andy Williams twice in concert and it was great. Hilariously funny.
Oh, really?
He was very, very funny, very entertaining. Did not take himself seriously at all.
We're going down some very long side routes here. I was watching the Andy Williams show on YouTube a while back, that because it featured an early Steve Martin. Steve Martin used to be the comedy foil on the Andy Williams show. Just kind of an odd variety. You know, these odd early 70s variety show on American TV. Yeah. They're quite strange.
But my favorite thing about the Andy Williams show that I saw, the second one, which is, you know, maybe only 3 or 4 years before he died. And as we were leaving, this elderly gentleman in the row behind put his hand on my shoulder and said, did you enjoy that? And I said, yes. And he said, it's great to see young people getting into Andy's music. And I thought, made my night. It's all relative. Everything is relative. Everything is relative.
So George and Harry were close, but I think, you know, as I said, geography might have kept them from being a little bit closer. Let's look at Harry's relationship with Paul, because Harry and Paul, they kind of become acquainted quite early. Harry appears with Paul in 1968. So when he does make that White Album visit, you know, Paul's very welcoming to him.
Yes. And if you think about it, they you know, he has covered She's Leaving Home, his sense of melody, his sense of arrangement, his sense of orchestration, all of those things put him firmly in sort of Paul's bailiwick, if you like. One of the first things that Paul does, Paul is producing Mary Hopkins' debut album for Apple, and he asks Harry, you know, write me a song for Mary Hopkins. And he does, the Puppy Song.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting you say that, you know, Harry's in Paul's bailiwick, because I'd agree with you there. I think in the arc of Harry's career, it's a pity he didn't work with Paul more, because, you know, I know he was hanging out with Ringo and John and having the fun, but in terms of his technicals or his musical skills, he's really aligned with Paul. He's a studio whiz. He's deeply melodic. He makes things look fantastically easy, you know?
Yeah.
And you could kind of think, well, actually, Paul and Harry, that should have been something that worked really well together. But, you know, Paul wasn't really plugged into the whole Harry lifestyle party thing.
I think I'm not having a dig at Paul, but this is the way it's going to go. Yes, I think personality wise, they're just not on the same page at all. And, you know, I'm not saying Paul doesn't have a sense of humor, but, you know.
But you are.
But, well, he doesn't have, I think, that dark sense of humor, that sort of sarcastic sense of humor that, you know, George and John and perhaps to a lesser extent Ringo, but Ringo is probably more about the partying. But
Paul doesn't like to waste time.
No.
And, you know, the others are pretty, you know, Lennon famously said, time you enjoy wasting is not wasted time.
Yeah.
But Paul is, you know, he's here to, you know, making albums in Rockdown and all the rest. He's going to get stuff done.
It's interesting that the first thing he says to Harry is, give me a song.
Yeah.
You know, I have this project. Let's get to work. Give me a song. I say it's the Puppy song. I don't know. Is that a deliberately kind of overly twee song that Harry delivers for Mary Hopkins?
I have to admit, when I first started listening to Harry Nilsson, it was because I was a Monkees fan. And so I went after some of those early albums. Mm. And when I first listened to them, so this must be about 25 years ago, I did think they were twee. I thought, you know, I don't really get what's happening here.
Yeah.
And it took me about another 10 or 15 years for the penny to drop. And I guess it's another thing he does that's part of Paul's talent base, which is he kind of writes certain songs in this pre-rock and roll idiom. You know, it reaches back to the 30s and 20s, you know, songs about puppies and songs about, you know,
railways
exactly, railways. And, you know, kind of, you know, some of his songs have this air of somebody kind of strolling along with a stick and a knotted handkerchief tied at the end of it over their shoulder, you know, looking at a sunset. So he's not governed by you know, the code that 1955 was when all good music started. And once you plug into that, he's kind of an all or nothing type of American songwriter and singer. The stuff kind of opens up. And so you would have thought that would have tickled Paul. He would have listened to those early Harry albums and said, oh, here's a like mind. And, you know, here's a song about a puppy. Yeah, I can get behind that. You know, Paul wouldn't mind.
And it's interesting that in the production for the Mary Hopkins album, Paul double tracks Mary Hopkins' voice. So he's kind of a little bit of a nod to what Harry is doing. And Mary Hopkins, huge fan. I think she describes Nilsson as my hero. And, you know, I'd love to get Mary Hopkins to come on to the podcast, but she doesn't.
She doesn't do interviews, amazingly.
She doesn't do interviews.
Active on Twitter, doesn't do interviews.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
But I'm a huge Mary Hopkins fan, particularly that kind of, not so much that first album, which is a little bit trying to be all things to all men, a little bit show busy. Mm. But she has an album called Earth Song, Ocean Song, which I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I have heard of that. I've got the Apple albums box set. I'm, you know, plugged into, I'm down with the kids.
Very good. It's a fantastic album. And I would say it's probably the best thing that came out on the Apple label. And I once did put that to Mary Hopkins on Twitter. And she said, well, maybe if you exclude the Boss's albums.
Nice. I mean, the first album, Postcard, is good, but it is a McCartney exercise. And so if you're interested in McCartney, it's worth having a listen, because he's basically A&Ring and producing and playing this album for her. But Earth Song is kind of where she has her own kind of voice. Yeah. It is very good. But getting back to the matter in hand, one of the interesting stories was that, you know, when Harry arrives in town in 1968, you know, he does link up with Paul McCartney, and there's a jam session, which is kind of curious.
This is an incredible thing. I there's two slightly different versions of it. One is that Paul goes to Harry's hotel and is just running through early drafts of songs that he's written for the White Album, including supposedly Blackbird. Harry tells it that Paul came to his apartment, but he does say it's on tape. He played four new songs he'd just written that ended up on three albums: She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, Teddy Boy, Blackbird, and one other, which he can't remember because we were drunk and harmonizing. So there is a tape somewhere of Paul McCartney and Harry Nilsson singing these songs.
Now the question is, does it exist, or is it just that there's a legend that there's a tape that exists?
Well, Harry does say there is a tape. You know, he actually does say, we did have a jam session one night at my apartment. That's on tape. And the other reference I've heard to this is Zach Nilsson.
Yeah, now we should talk about Zach Nilsson a little bit, because he has been a very visible online presence and custodian of Harry's. He's one of Harry's sons, and he's been looking after Harry's history and archive and representation, really. But sadly, Zach is quite ill at the moment.
He is quite seriously ill, and I've been following his posts on social media and Facebook, and you know, I think the prognosis there is not good. And
he's been pretty open about a terminal cancer diagnosis that he's dealing with at the moment, and we send him all our good wishes and
wish him all the best. But he posted in February of last year that he had got a letter from Paul saying, you know, basically just the same thing, wishing him all the best. And this led on to an interview. And the interviewer said, you know, have you and Paul ever met? And he said, no, Harry always wanted us to meet, but it just never happened. But Paul knew of me. He hung out with Harry and my mom, Diane. And then he says, there is a recording of Paul playing Blackbird for Harry and my mom with Linda in a hotel room before the White Album was released. Harry was harmonizing along. So Paul knew of me when I was born. I suppose there's a possibility we met when I was a baby. So that raises the prospect. Has he heard the tape, or has he just heard of the tape?
Yes, you'd wonder.
Or, you know, is it a legend that sort of grows slightly in the telling?
He's heard a legend that there's a tape, so there must be a tape. We just don't know, but it's tantalizing. Yeah.
It just is that prospect. But then again, you think, is this just going to be one of those sessions where he was drunk, Paul was drunk, everybody was drunk? But you still want to hear it.
I mean, he published the letter that Paul sent him, and he was very touched by it. And just as a side point, it's just such a very sweet and lovely thing that Paul did. And he said in the letter, I was privileged to know your dad, who is a lovely guy, and I wish you the best of luck with all your treatment. And my wife, Nancy, went through it years ago, and she stuck with it, even though she hated it. She's now better and well, but unfortunately she's married to me. Sending you the best wishes, Paul. And it's just a mark of the guy. It's very sweet.
It's very sweet.
To do something for someone who's in that situation. Paul and Harry don't really develop a very deep working relationship. And again, this story of meeting in the hotel room in 68, it's classic Paul, where we're not going to get drunk. We're going to sing songs and get drunk. And we're going to go through our songbooks and get drunk. So there's always a little bit of work involved. But Paul and Harry do cross paths later on, and we'll come back to that later on. But as we said earlier on, it's kind of with Ringo and John that Harry forms the strongest bonds. And we're going to talk about that right after this break.
End of part one. Intermission.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So it was with Ringo Starr that Harry was really, you know, closest to, and Ringo describes Harry as my best friend at one point. They grow close, first of all, when Harry's in London, isn't that right?
Yes. So, you know, Harry stays in London, he does some recording in London, and this is where he starts accumulating the characters around him, like Ringo and Keith Moon, Mark Bolan, Graham Chapman from Monty Python. That would be a good party, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't pay the bar tab, but yes.
No. You'd like to kind of look in through the window at that party. But
I do sometimes feel when you read these stories, I think, you know, when you're young, you think, oh, that would have been great fun. Now that I'm old, I'm like, oh my God, I would have, if I'd seen what they were up to, I would have just left and gone somewhere else.
Well, at my age, all I can think of, what must they have felt like the next day?
They kept it going the next day. That was the problem.
I think their response was, yes, just keep going. Just don't stop. He seems to have been closest with Ringo for the longest period. So it's a very deep friendship. They work together on Ringo's solo album. So you've got Ringo in 1973, Goodnight Vienna, Rotogravure, all the way up to Stop and Smell the Roses. And I'm sure you'll want to talk about that album for several hours when we get there. And, you know, again, we talked on the episode where we looked at the Ringo album about You're 16.
Yes.
And the vocal arrangement. And if you take, you know, it's almost a Harry Nilsson track, because all of the vocal arrangements on that, it's all sung by Harry. And then Ringo comes and puts his vocal over the top. And try listening to it. I'm going to say try listening to Ringo Starr's song and ignore Ringo's vocals. But it's a great song. And I love that album. And it's fantastic. But you really want to listen to that track to appreciate what Harry brings to the table there.
Yeah, there's a couple of overlaps with things we've talked about before. So if you go back and listen to our 1974 episode and our Films of Ringo Starr episode, there's plenty of Ringo and Harry Nilsson information in there. But for the Goodnight Vienna album, there's a very famous advert which Harry is in as well, where and it's hard to believe that stimulants might have been involved, but Ringo as a spaceman is flown to the top of the Capitol Tower in LA and yes. is waving at the population below from the roof. I mean, I shudder to think of the insurance of putting a beetle on top of yes. a skyscraper. Yes. But Harry is also there on the roof as well, kind of wandering around in his gown or in the background.
He's sitting in a deck chair yes. reading a news, you know, the album, the video for Only You. He's sitting in a deck chair in a bathrobe reading a newspaper.
Yes.
So it's just, why not?
And there's also Ringo repays the debt to Harry, because Ringo appears in an ad for a Harry album. Have you seen this one? I think it's Do It on Monday.
Yeah,
where Harry was a keen basketball player. And if you haven't seen this ad, Harry is, I think, on the floor where the LA Lakers play, and he just lobs a basketball from one end of the court straight into the basket at the other end of the court. And Ringo's in the audience applauding. He's the only person in the audience. It's really, really quite funny. But they were thick as thieves. They just loved each other.
They really were. And it kind of just that, I think that those two videos you've described kind of sums up their relationship and where they were in the 70s. And if you're, you know, great pals, you've got access to all the money in the world, why wouldn't you just do those crazy things, you know?
And we talked in the Films of Ringo Starr episode that obviously Harry and Ringo starred together in Son of Dracula. And I know that since we've done that episode, you've been down in the British Library or somewhere just digging out more facts.
Yes, but I mean, I started off these notes by saying, you know, a list of Harry's achievements and saying, you know, and he starred in the worst Dracula movie ever. But then I thought, is it though? Is it really the worst Dracula movie ever? A friend of mine very kindly got me a copy of that movie, a decent copy on DVD for Christmas. Thanks, Robert. And I've really come to, I've watched it, I think, three times since Christmas when I'm recording in February. I've been sending away for an old back issue of Shindig and reading articles about it. And the more I think about it, this is, we've got to start petitioning Ringo to get this album, to get this movie back out there.
But the Shindig magazine article does confirm that there is an alternate soundtrack, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The film sort of opened and closed literally in one day, and Ringo took it away and, you know, got Graham Chapman and Douglas Adams from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to work up an alternative dialogue in the style of What's Up, Tiger Lily, the Woody Allen film. And this apparently does exist. And I haven't heard it, but there's a bootleg copy because Harry screened the movie with the alternative soundtrack at a Beatlefest.
Yeah.
Beatlefest, yeah.
And so Ringo is, you know, I've never really seen Ringo interviewed in recent years, particularly about Harry Nilsson. There was a Harry Nilsson documentary that came out a few years ago called Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him, which is worth seeking out. He's not visible in that in any contemporaneous interviews. And there's interviews with everybody in that except Ringo.
I wonder, is Ringo just a very emotional?
I think it is. I think he's an emotional guy, and it's very raw. He did write a song on the album Liverpool 8 about Harry, called Harry's Song.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful song, and you know, Liverpool 8, I have to say, is just another Ringo Starr album.
Yes.
But Harry's Song just
not the Clannad song, we should point out.
No, Harry's theme. Is that
Harry's
theme?
Yeah,
Harry's theme. Not the Clannad song. Oh dear. With the vocals on that. Anyway, sorry, completely throwing me now. But yeah, Harry's song. And he says, all I need is my imagination. Take me far away where I can be with everyone who loves me. Can we get back the past?
Oh,
and it's very kind of explicitly just looking back on those times he had with Harry. And it's in a way, I'm not comparing the two relationships, but it's a much more explicitly sort of open and touching song about a deceased friend than anything he's done for John. You know, his references to John and songs are sort of slightly oblique. But this is you really do feel he's kind of laying everything out on the page here, you know?
Yeah. So Harry and Ringo's friendship is very true, but also Harry and John, we know, is another relationship altogether. And when we bring John Lennon and Harry together, you know, we start to look at they wrote songs together, they made albums together, and you know, he's a key part in what's euphemistically known as John's Lost Weekend.
Yes.
Harry and John originally bonded again in that 68 period when he comes over for the White Album.
Yes, this was something that was a piece of information that was new to me, but this is from the Beatles Bible site, and it recounts that during the White Album session, John and Harry sort of challenged each other to write a song with the same title. And You Are Here was the title from an art exhibition that John had held at the Robert Fraser Gallery in July of 68, with Yoko, sort of one of their first things together. And that was John suggested You Are Here as the title. There's a song by that title pops up on Lennon's 73 Mind Games album. Harry recorded a demo, but didn't take it any further, but it turns up on a box set that we'll maybe talk about at some point.
Turns up in 2013.
That was actually that demo was discovered during the making of the documentary you referenced.
And similarly, you know, when we talked about Harry covering George Harrison, you know, in March 71 he records a version of Lennon's Isolation from Plastic Ono Band. So again, he's a super fan. You know, 4 months after the album comes out, he's recording a very sincere, heartfelt cover version. So he's really paying attention to what they're doing and, you know, is picking out songs that suit him for him to cover.
It's, and again, the content, the sort of emotional content of that song is right on message for Harry.
Yeah. And all roads lead then to 1974. And it's when John is based in LA that Harry becomes a very fast friend to John Lennon. And Harry's also part of this group, you know, the Hollywood Vampires, which is Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, Alice Cooper, Harry Nilsson, plus or minus John Lennon when he's in town. And they are just a group of, rock and roll characters / bores.
Yes, drunks,
depending what side of the fence you're on.
Ringo would say, yes, this is the point at which they stopped being musicians that drank and they became drunks that occasionally played music. You know, it seems to be just a relocation of that early 70s London scene is transposed, and then and you've got some LA characters join in for larks.
Yes. And so March 74 is when the famous Smothers Brothers incident happens.
Yes. So again, there's a bit of an overlap with the 74 episode here. Essentially at one point they're sharing a house together, they're recording together, they're going out socializing together. May Pang says, you know, Harry would keep feeding John drinks until it all went horribly wrong. And the Smothers Brothers incident, this was in March of 74. The Smothers Brothers were sort of US, they had a kind of, I suppose it was almost like a variety show that they had, their comics. Mike and Bernie Winters, you know.
Looking at the Smothers Brothers now that they were seen as subversive, very popular with, you know, the sort of late 60s liberal politics. George had appeared on a Smothers Brothers show as a surprise guest in late 68 when he was visiting, you know, pre-White Album release when he was visiting LA. So they were very sort of, you know, popular with kind of the liberal politics of the time. And, you know, they kept in that loop. So, you know, when they'd be playing gigs at the Troubadour, that they weren't your standard variety type of show. They would attract, you know, your John Lennons and your Troubadour type style. And even still, they were quite, you know, when they recount the incident after the fact, they were quite forgiving about it, really.
They were. So this seems to have been a sort of a comeback show for them, or they were sort of a relaunch. And, you know, they're doing their stand-up routine, and they recount the fact that during the routine, they start to become aware of somebody shouting and, you know, sort of language involved, and it was getting quite rowdy, and people were, there were the arguments between people on tables. And then there was a scuffle, the show was stopped, Lennon was ejected. But as you say, they're very forgiving, and they say, oh, you know, he sent flowers the next day and everything was fine. But this is the point at which, you know, a waitress alleged that she was hit during the fracas. There was a valet attendant suggested the same. There was a photographer. And it's interesting that Lennon subsequently does point the finger at Harry. You know, May Pang says Harry is the one, you know, John, everybody knows what John is like. You need to kind of keep an eye on him. Harry would just egg him on, would keep feeding him drink. And I'm sure everybody's seen that old Grey Whistle Test interview from 1975. Yes. So he alludes to this, and he sort of says, you know, well, look, yeah, you know, I was with Harry. He encouraged me. I usually have someone that says, okay, don't. And then he says, but you know what? I did this in Liverpool before I was famous. It's just now that I'm famous, gets in the papers and people sue me. But he's very clear. And I think there is another interview later, maybe on the Tom Snyder show, mm-hmm. where he very specifically says it was Harry Nilsson. And it's a little bit more accusatory than he is on the whistle test, you know? Yes.
That was then. The big project, though, that they're heading towards is, you know, what do you do when you've got a house with Harry Nilsson and John Lennon in it, is you make an album. And the album is Harry Nilsson's 10th album, which is called Pussycats, which is kind of a half covers, half originals album produced by Lennon in starting at the end of March and into April 1974. And, you know, it's all kicking off at that point. On the first day of recording, that's the famous day that McCartney shows up at the house, and that's the Toot and the Snore bootleg where, as we've recounted before, Paul appears the next day and Harry says, Paul, would you like to try some of this? And Paul says, what is it? And Harry says, it's horse tranquilizer. And Paul says, no, I don't think that's a good idea. And Harry's like, okay, all the more horse tranquilizer for Harry.
But that's again, this illustrates Paul, Harry, not really on the same page.
Really, no. Paul turns up at a recording session expecting recording to get done, and it doesn't happen. And the party takes over instead. But yeah, on that day that Paul turns up at the house for his last interaction with John Lennon in a studio, that's the first day of recording of Harry's album, Pussycats. They record Subterranean Homesick Blues on day one. And on the next day, the 29th, they record the album's opening track, Many Rivers to Cross. Pussycats as an album is, I don't know if it's any good. I can't decide.
You don't like it at all?
Well, you know, considering how much I love some of Harry's other music, you know, I could imagine, as you know, if I'd been on the earth in March 74, if I'd heard that Harry Nilsson and John Lennon were recording an album, I'd be like, I cannot wait to hear this.
Yes.
Fantastic. And it kind of comes to that thing we've talked about earlier on, which is, you know, Harry and Paul as a melodic studio combo. Wow. But Harry and John, it doesn't add up to the sum of its promise, of its key talents, when you think about what they've done already.
I think that's a fair comment. I mean, I certainly wouldn't rate it as one of Harry's best albums, but it is an album that I think contains tracks, individual moments, which I think are fantastic. But they both at this stage were at low points, I suppose. You know, John was taking on this project specifically because he felt he was wasting time. He was, you know, he'd been working with Phil Spector. It wasn't going anywhere. He became very aware of the fact that he was making headlines for all the wrong reasons. This was a project that he could take on to sort of pull himself out without the responsibility of delivering product under his own name. Nilsson at this stage doesn't have the original material. You know, he doesn't have original songs available and ready to go. So it falls back into that, oh, let's do some cover versions, which is what John has been doing. And can I mention the who peed on the mixing desk, that letter?
If you must.
If you must. This is sort of indicative of the way they were working. So this was a few years ago. Rolling Stone reported on a letter that John wrote to Phil Spector blaming Keith Moon and Harry Nilsson for peeing on a recording console, and basically saying, should you not yet. No, it was Harry and Keith who pissed on the console. I can't be expected to mind adult rock stars, nor can May. Besides, she works for me, not A&M. I'm about to piss off to the record plant because of this. So John is trying to keep Harry Nilsson, Ringo Starr, Keith Moon under control. So yeah, it's not ideal circumstances, shall we say.
No, but they spend April 74 mainly putting this album together, and
what you don't like. It's his voice you don't like. It's a voice. Well,
we should talk about the famous story, which is that Harry's voice changes during this, yes, album, and you know, his voice is not the same afterwards. And what previously, you know, just a year before, he's doing a Touch of Schmielsen in the Night, his covers album with an orchestra, and there is a BBC performance of that album which is extraordinary to watch, where this orchestra starts up, Harry saunters into the room and hits, You Must Remember This on cue, on note, sings it beautifully. And if memory serves, he's either holding a drink or a cigarette or something, like total nonchalance. But you get to 1974 and he's recording with Lennon at the desk. And the legend goes that in order to hit the power of Many Rivers to Cross, he is singing through throat nodule problems, and he causes irreparable damage to his singing voice. And yes, people, amateur rock and roll psychologists have said, was he, too drunk to care? Was he showing off to Lennon? Did he not want to let the side down? Why this happened, we don't really know. But it makes Many Rivers to Cross, not an easy listen.
For anybody that came to Nilsson through, yep, Without You or A Little Touch of Schmielsen in the Night, this is not easy listening. But do you not think it sounds like John Lennon?
It sounds like John Lennon. It sounds, the strings are those number nine dream strings.
Vocally, he sounds like Lennon on Mother or one of those.
Yes, towards the end of the song he does.
Yeah, it's almost as if he's aping what Lennon was doing on this is therapy Lennon. This is what he's doing. So in that sense, it's very jarring to move from, the year before, and on Goodnight Vienna, he's doing these beautiful sort of vocal arrangements for Ringo, and now he is just screaming this vocal.
Yeah, it's also, this notion of how albums get sequenced or how they, how they appear, and, the first to open the album with that song instead of, there are one or two very gentle, delicate Nilsson moments on the album, but to open with that song, it's a bit of an assault. And, I don't reach for Pussycats often as an album of comfort. And I know not every piece of music is supposed to make you feel comfortable, but you kind of feel this doesn't sound well. It
sounds like there's that, and there's Save the Last Dance for Me, and they sound as if they were recorded at the end of a really intensive kind of 18-month world tour of, yes, it sounds like a really road weary voice. It's not the album. I can't defend it. There's some terrible sort of childish nonsense in there, but there are some beautiful moments. But I think it does mark the point at which Harry's voice changes sort of irreparably.
Yeah, and it's sort of kind of a certain watermark for Harry. I mean, yeah, the highlights in the album are, you know, All My Life is a lovely, gentle Harry original. Black Sails is another great song. But
yes,
Lennon's actually got nothing to do with Black Sails. It's recorded about a month or two after the album itself.
Yeah, yeah. You're not a big fan of Rock Around the Clock, no?
No, it's... I always worry if an album sounds like it was more fun to make than to listen to, that's a problem.
I've talked to you before about the Keith Moon solo album. That's
Two
exactly...
Two Sides of the Moon or Both Sides of the Moon?
Yeah. It's shocking. and again, arrives from sort of the same point. But it is, one of the people that was hanging around in LA that doesn't seem to have got caught up in the mayhem and the madness was Jimmy Webb.
Oh, yeah.
You know, great, fantastically talented songwriter. And he comments... about the fact that, you know, this is Harry began to dismantle his genius, you know, to systematically destroy his own talent. This jewel that was, you know, this blessing from God, and his voice is just disappearing. And again, there is, you said, you know, there is a kind of psychology about it. Jimmy Webb tells a great story about Harry and John after that Smothers Brothers show, turning up at his door and saying, "We were with you. We need you to go down to the police station and tell the police that you are our alibi." And amazingly, Jimmy Webb does it.
Fair play to him.
Fair play to him. But you know, this is there were friends of Harry's who were extremely concerned at this point that he was just squandering the talent, and it was deliberate.
Like in terms of the timeline, you know, we're kind of zoning in on Harry and the Beatles, but, you know, Harry has had this successful solo career. After his debut album comes out at the end of 67, you know, the two songs he's known most for is Everybody's Talking, which was written by Fred Neil, and Without You, which was written by Hammond Evans from Badfinger. And these were two massive hits. Everybody's Talking was the first one from the Midnight Cowboy movie. And then that brings him into the realm of Richard Perry as a producer, who produces his breakthrough album, Nielsen Schmielsen, which everybody, I assume, listening to this owns a copy. If you don't own a copy of Nielsen Schmielsen, it's perfect. And Nielsen Schmielsen should have been the template for how Harry rolled out across the 70s, because it's an album that keeps giving to us many years later. A song like Gotta Get Up has featured in the Netflix show Russian Doll. Jump Into the Fire is a song that many bands keep rediscovering, like LCD Sound System have done a fantastic cover of it. Coconut is on Nielsen Schmielsen, and obviously Quentin Tarantino used Coconut in Reservoir Dogs. So that was the big hit album. But Harry being Harry, you know, didn't tour it, didn't bring it anywhere. At best, he did this BBC One TV special, which is a great thing to have in the archives. But this is how he's spending his 1970, 71, 72, that instead of capitalizing on this, he is not touring. He is enjoying the lifestyle more. And it all seems to come to a head with Pussycats, where, you know, there's a line in his career of before Pussycats and after Pussycats.
I think that's fair enough. I think that's a fair comment. There is a fantastically revisionist review in Pitchfork of
Pussycats. Yes, you sent this to me, and you know, I took 3 or 4 hours out to read it because it was a Pitchfork review, obviously.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It was time well spent. But you know, I think although they identify and they do sing its praises, I think they do recognize that there are, you know, irredeemable failures in there. But I thought that the final line of that, where they describe him as being the drinking buddy of every rock star, and they say picture book drunkards like Harry live their lives in cheerful, elegant gestures of failure and small pain declarations of success. Pussycats contained a little of both. Yeah. And I think that, I thought, as Pitchfork reviews do, that just, you know, summed it up. Once you plow through the 50 pages, you get the key. And I think that probably describes his career and his life from here on in. But you know, at this point, he's hanging out with John Lennon. He's writing songs with John Lennon. You know,
he'd say he's having a great time.
Yeah.
So there's two interesting things that lead out from Pussycats, which is the songwriting and the album cover. So from the songwriting point of view, Harry does write with John. And so there's two songs of note. One is on Pussycats, there's Mucho Mungo / Mount Elgo, which is really just a John song welded to a Harry song.
That's pretty much it. Mucho Mungo was a song that John originally sort of wrote with Phil Spector during the rock and roll sessions. There's a version of that on the anthology box, the Lennon anthology.
Yeah, from 98.
Box, and Lennon records a couple of home demos. Supposedly he wrote it with Jesse Ed Davis, we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. And there is a cassette tape that I've seen a photograph of with you know, him, Lennon's writing. This is, you know, for Jesse Davis. But he played it to Harry. Harry liked it. He didn't like the Phil Spector bits. I think that was maybe a diplomatic not liking the Phil Spector bit. And they kind of put two songs together. And but they dropped, I like the line that they dropped, "Sailing on the good ship Lollipop, open a drugstore, a nice kind of shop." So, but yeah, so he suddenly, you know, this is this Beatles super fan has a co-writing credit with John Lennon.
Well, the other song they write together is a, you know, perhaps a bit more substantive or a bit less welded together, and that's, you know, a reasonably well-known song called Old Dirt Road, which you know, is a song born of 1974, and it first appears on John's Walls and Bridges album. And there's a couple of different variants of this, because Harry eventually records it himself in 1980 on his album Flash Harry. Do you have a favorite version, Stephen?
I like the stripped back versions that you get on Men Love Avenue or Anthology. I think probably the Men Love Avenue, Lennon's kind of stripped back take on that. You know, again, we've touched on this. Walls and Bridges, there's a lot of people love Walls and Bridges, but I just find it very difficult to get past that really dense kitchen sink production.
Well, I'd agree with you. I think the, you know, the version of Old Dirt Road that Harry puts out in 1980, you know, from the room next door, it sounds very similar to the John version. But when you listen to Harry's voice by 1980, it's not pretty, and it's not a great cover version. The version of Old Dirt Road I like from the 98 Lennon anthology is great. It doesn't have that Walls and Bridges fog on it, so to speak. And you know, given what we heard with Gimme Some Truth, I'm looking forward to the Walls and Bridges six disc deluxe remix remastered.
I was going to say, it was the couple of tracks from Walls and Bridges that really sold out to me, I have to say.
So that's their rewrite. But what I find deeply amusing / cynical is that John Lennon is on the cover of Pussycats, because you always put your producer on the cover of your album,
of course,
with their name as big or bigger than yours. Why would you do that? Sales, cynicism, you know,
sales, money. Yeah, it was a lark. It was a joke. they were Batman and Robin. They were a team.
Well, again, you know, you'd look at that cover and you'd think, hey, that's John Lennon from the Beatles. And that's Harry Nilsson, who had that big hit a year or two ago. And they've got an album together and it looks fantastic. There's a clue on the album cover, though, that all is not what it seems.
There is. So originally the album was supposed to be called Strange Pussies, but the record company wasn't having it.
Stronger heads prevailed.
So, but yes, the people who don't know the cover, it's sort of Harry and John as little kind of, are they like teddy bears or something?
They're kind of poking their heads through a scene. Yeah. It's like a cartoony scene.
And there's a table and there's a rug on the floor and there's a building blocks with letters on it, and there's a D, and then there's a rug, and then there's an S. So it spells rugs.
Very clever.
You see what they did there?
I have to admit, I love a good rebus.
I did not. I had never heard of that name. That was my, you know, did you know that?
Of course, everyone knows what a rebus is. Okay, a rebus is a puzzle that's a mixture of letters and drawings, listeners. So that's a rebus.
Ian Rankin, Inspector Rebus. That's who I was thinking of. But, I'll ask Ian Rankin on Twitter if that's where he got
that. That's where Rebus comes from. Lennon is on the cover, and you know, this album comes out in 1974, and it's Nilsson's 10th album on RCA. So since Pandemonium Shadow Show back in 1974, this is album number 10. And it seems to be that Lennon is being used as leverage for Harry's record contract, and also, you know, Harry is being used as leverage for RCA to get to Lennon, perhaps.
Yeah, I think there's a trade-off here. Everybody's playing everybody, but principally, I think John and Harry are in it together. Mm. You know, there was a lot of speculation in 74, 75. The Beatles contracts are coming to an end. Are they going to re-sign with EMI and Capitol? Are they, you know, going to move to other companies? So I think undoubtedly the cover is one to sell records, because you think, is this a Harry Nilsson, John Lennon duets album?
Yeah,
I think that would have been an interesting.
That would have been a better project. Yeah,
I think you know, but presumably because John is contracted to Capitol EMI at that point, that's not a runner. So they're first of all to sell the record, and secondly to sell Harry. Hmm. So the story is that in renegotiating that contract, John goes with Harry, you know, like taking your mum along, your dad along to, and he sits in and he kind of is dropping hints that if RCA play right by Harry, well, when his record contract comes up for renewal, he might just sign with RCA as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And Harry gets $5 million.
The Harry Nilsson is... when you look at his body of work, it is indicative as to how much money was floating around the music industry at the time, that he managed to make 10 records in 7 years, get a $5 million contract, and live well and comfortably off without ever touring, and you know, really only having one significant breakthrough album, which is Nilsson.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the thing. If you had one big album like that, those were the days when record companies tended to stick with you for a while, you know, to give you another shot. But I think undoubtedly the $5 million was really, I suspect, regarded as a down payment on Lennon,
which never came to pass. So 1974 and Pussycats is probably the high watermark of Harry Nilsson interacting with the Beatles, when he shares an album sleeve and writing credits with John Lennon. Beyond 1974, 75, everybody kind of takes things a little bit more easy. You know, John retreats into his house husband mode, as we know, in the second half of the 70s. You know, George goes into Friar Park mode in the second half of the 70s. Paul was never really going to keep Harry on speed dial.
No.
And if we kind of look at Harry as we tip into the 1980s, it's a different type of interaction that he has. So as you say, he's working on Stop and Smell the Roses with Ringo when we get to the 80s. The big thing that affects Harry is the murder of John in December 1980.
Yes, that seems to have been you know, a turning point. And it does seem that in the sort of couple of years before 1980, perhaps he and John weren't hanging out so much. There wasn't as much contact. You know, John was in the house husband years. But this seems to have sort of galvanized Harry in a way. He was not regarded as being a particularly kind of politically active. You know, Lennon went through his political phase. But after Lennon's murder, Harry takes up the cause of gun control in America, and really kind of throws himself into that. And, you know, the music is his career at this stage. You know, he has that album Flash Harry in 1980 that you mentioned. Ringo appears on that, but he's not recording. He records Drumming Is My Madness. He writes that for Ringo in Stop It, Smell the Roses. Yeah. But he's not producing a lot of material on his own account.
Yeah, he's left RCA Records at this point, and Flash Harry is not an RCA album. And Flash Harry actually opens with a song written and performed by Eric Idle, which is an odd conceit, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a song about Harry Nilsson, written in that jaunty Eric Idle, you know, end of the pier style. But the album also has Harry's very sincere reading of Monty Python's Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It's an odd album, Flash Harry, to say the least.
Because it's a sort of, that's almost a sort of sign off, you know, his yeah. his voice is shot. He's writing material.
He's writing material for a Popeye film as well at the same time. Robert Altman's yes. Popeye.
Yes. Not a great hit, that film, as I recall.
I was a very tiny child and I was brought to that film. And I remember being quite bamboozled about everything that was going on. This was not a 5-minute cartoon. This was
no.
some kind of odd bonfire of money.
you were never quite the same.
No,
again.
It explains a lot, actually.
Yeah. My favorite collaboration with Ringo here is on the song "How Long Can Disco On." You see what they did there?
How long can disco on? Yes.
This was the level that they were, which they were operating at this point.
Well, if you do want to talk about Drumming Is My Madness for a second, because
please do. I know how much you love this.
Drumming Is My Madness is a Ringo song that is simultaneously the greatest and the worst Ringo song ever. It's extraordinary. Yep. And you know, it's 11 years since, you know, or 10 years since the Beatles ended by the time he's putting it down onto tape. Mm-hmm. And he's singing repeatedly, "Drumming is my madness, drumming is my weakness." And then at one point he says, "Let me now riz off." And he does a very sort of tepid drum solo. And it's very nicely arranged and produced in Harry's defense. But it's, it's, you can't help but feel how the mighty have fallen when you hear "Drumming is my madness."
It is indicative. I mean, it really is indicative of that slide, you know. Yeah. And going into the 80s, you know, he's not producing a lot of music. You can see Ringo, what happens to his career in the 80s. But he does, Harry Nilsson does throw himself into Gun Control. And he develops then this relationship with Yoko.
Yes, and that's very sweet. He writes to Yoko at the end of 81 and, you know, is very heartfelt about how he feels about the whole situation. And he goes off to record some Yoko songs then in 1982.
He does. He writes to Yoko, and just read that out. He says, this was at the end of 81, and he writes, "Dear Bag of Laughs, now that we're both in our 40s, I guess it's okay to talk straight. John and I once had a great Yoko versus Una debate." Una being Harry's
wife. Amazing wife, who pops up in that documentary, who yes. Harry was devoted to yep. from the time he first met her, about 1972, until his death in 1994. And if you watch the documentary, she is hugely entertaining. She's an Irish lady, which obviously
helps
adds to the charm. But she's Una, Harry's wife, is fascinating.
So he writes, "John said you were the blues, and I said what I could. Then I got to thinking about Harry's fourth law, which clearly states that the brighter the light, the more likely it is to be extinguished." And you think that's a lovely sort of thing to write, and you know, particularly
he does mean it.
Yeah. And, you know, again, if you kind of think the majority of the time where Harry was closest to John is when John was not with Yoko.
Yeah. Yeah. So he does record Yoko songs in 1982, and these eventually appear in various places, but predominantly on an early 80s Yoko tribute album, Every Man Has a Woman.
Yes. Have you got that album?
No. I've heard it in bits and pieces. I know Costello's on it. Yeah, I've got his version of Walking on Thin Ice. I'm aware of that, but I've never heard the whole thing.
It's a very interesting album, and it's the sort of the first attempt, I think, to sort of recast Yoko slightly. Yeah. I think it's too early in her career, or too close to John's death, really, to do that. But then he also records Never Say Goodbye, which turns up on a sort of 1993 album, and Listen, the Snow Is Falling, which was the B-side of Happy Christmas. And that finally came out in 2019 on Lost and Found, which was a sort of posthumous album that was curated by his family.
Yeah, after Flash Harry, he didn't release another proper album in his lifetime, but he was working on an album up until his death. And it plugs back into this notion that he was primarily a fan, that he had enough knowledge of Yoko's career to pull those songs out and to reinterpret them and to understand them. And almost in a full circle movement, you know, for a guy who didn't do live performances or live appearances, in the 80s, he starts appearing in what are becoming increasingly popular Beatle Fests in America. And he's doing them for two reasons. One is he's using them as leverage to promote his gun control politics.
Yeah.
But also he performs live at some of these Beatle Fests, singing songs. Now, not doing full gigs, but like considering he's not somebody who would take to the stage, there is YouTube footage of him at these Beatle Fests singing "You Can't Do That" and "Give Peace a Chance." It's very curious.
And it does seem to have the main sort of impetus for this does seem to have been the promotion of that sort of gun control aspect. And there's a story that pops up in his biography. And it says in 1982, he wrote a song called Judy/With a Bullet. And this was an auction.
Oh, yeah.
Where you could pay. Harry Nilsson would write a song.
Oh.
About you. And a lady called Judy paid, I think it was $250. Paid $250 to get Harry Nilsson to write a song about you. But I, what's more interesting or what's fascinating is he's doing this at a time when he's financially in trouble. He's really sort of up against it in the 80s. But yet he's not focusing on a career. He's very recording very in a very kind of haphazard fashion. Yoko helps him out financially in the late 80s. Ringo steps in and buys him a house. So people are sort of rallying around.
He's hugely loved. And, you know, the other flip side of this is that during the 80s, he was just rearing a family. He had settled down at Una. He had a number of children. And, you know, he probably would have said he was quite happy watching his kids grow up, you know?
Yeah. Have you heard him singing "I Love New York" in June?
Yes, from the Fisher King, which is one of his last things.
So again, 1991, Terry Gilliam gets him in to record that. And again, I think that's a great version. His voice really suits that. You know, so he was very, very tight with the Python guys, with Eric Idle. And, you know, Eric Idle, I think, was part of that rambunctious crowd.
And he did appear on stage with the Pythons at one point, didn't he?
On stage and off stage, yes.
off stage by accident.
By accident, yeah. The Pythons were in New York, and they would get people on to sort of stand in the chorus of the Lumberjack song. And Harry did that, fell off stage and vanished into the audience. And Eric Idle recounts it was only 2 or 3 days later they realized he'd broken his arm and had been carted off to hospital. You know, Eric Idle speaks very fondly of him in his autobiography, but in a slightly rueful way that he never really cleaned up, and he didn't get the kind of second chance that Ringo got, or even the Graham Chapman, you know, cleaned up. And
it sort of has a tone of, you know, oh, he was at the end of the day, he was his own worst enemy and he should have gotten it together, you know, which, you know, it's kind of hard to know what the right side of these things is. But again, in a full circle kind of motion, his last appearance on stage is in September 1992, and he joins Ringo and his all-star band, Friends Till the End. He comes on and he sings "Without You."
I haven't heard that. Don't know if there's YouTube clip, but the commentary says Todd Rundgren, who was in the band at the time, he was really covering for the high notes, but that was in Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And it's nice that his kind of last performance was with Ringo and that they came full circle.
Yes. And then, so Harry had a heart attack in February 1993, and realizing that his health was failing, he was trying to get his affairs in order. He was trying to finish this unreleased album, which had the working title of "Papa's Got a Brand New Robe," which is funny.
I think that is. I wish they'd gone with that instead of "Lost and Found."
And and he was also trying to put together, a retrospective, full-on career box set of his time at RCA. But he didn't get to see either of these things in his lifetime. He died in January 1994, and you know, there's a lot to be sad about and a lot to regret in that. But, I think as you were touching upon there, he was somebody who should have had a victory lap, you know?
Yes.
There is no
yes.
reason to think that, a 60-year-old Harry Nilsson in the 21st century couldn't have, you know, played the Meltdown Festival in the Royal Festival Hall and got standing ovations and toured the way, you know, you see victory laps that have happened for Brian Wilson. And he was somebody who should have had that moment.
Yes, his catalogue would absolutely have lent itself to that. You know, it's not a kind of rock and roll, outrageous showman, where you don't want to see a 60-year-old cavorting around stage. I mean, he absolutely would have knocked that out of the park, I think.
Yeah.
And have you heard the Lost and Found album?
I have. I think I need to go back to it again because, you know, when you hear, oh, here's a Harry Nilsson album that, you know, has been in the can for 25 years, your expectation is high. And I don't think my immediate expectations were met. I was also kind of a bit struck that I was a bit discombobulated hearing him again, you know?
Yes, I bought it and then I didn't listen to it. I bought it when it came out. And then I really didn't want to listen to it. It didn't get great reviews. It sort of got okay reviews.
Yeah.
It is made up of things recorded at different times, and it's produced by Mark Hudson, who worked with Ringo back in the day before they fell out. And it is a bit of a mishmash, but I started listening to it just at the end of last year and just incessantly on repeat. And I think it's just such a treat to hear him again. And there's a particular track called UCLA, which is all about the Beatles. It's this kind of very slow rolling melody. And he sort of laments the loss of friends and he references New York and he references the Beatles and he talks about Penny Lane and Ringo Starr. And I have to say, I think it's as good as anything he has ever put out. It's a beautiful song and it's worth it, the album, just for that, I think.
It's, Harry is someone who, you know, was always, print the legend seemed to be true for Harry. And there's a legend even at his funeral. There's kind of the legend of the earthquake. And then there's the legend of George being at his funeral. One is true.
What is true and what is not true? Yeah. Say he died in 94. And in the mid to late 90s, there was a story started circulating that an earthquake had taken place in LA after Harry's death and that his coffin had fallen into the crevice created by the earthquake and was lost, and they basically buried an empty coffin. And Lawrence Juber tells the story. He does a little instrumental tribute called "When Harry Got to Heaven" on his album Mosaic, and he references this story. But there's a website called legendsrevealed.com, and they trace this back to a review in The Independent in the UK of a 1997 Marianne Faithfull concert. And they say, she sits down, lights up, coughs some more. It sounds like every Marianne Faithfull concert I've ever been at. I'm a big fan. And tells a story. And she said, as if it wasn't, he survived the 60s, but he had the misfortune to be swindled by his accountant before dying in a dentist's chair. Well, that didn't happen. If that wasn't bad enough, he then disappeared in his coffin as the earth opened up during the Los Angeles quake. Marianne Faithfull sings a song in memory of Harry and promises him a line of coke when they next meet. Well, none of that is true. There was an earthquake that took place in LA in 1994, just a couple of days after Harry died, but that's about it. He died in his sleep. He was working on his album. He went home. He went to bed. He didn't wake up. There were some aftershocks during the funeral, but there is no record of any funeral home being destroyed. And it didn't happen. But I guess that's a story Harry would have enjoyed. He would have loved.
It is true that George was at the funeral and led the singing. What song did he choose?
Well, this is Mark Hudson, who was producing Harry's album at the time, and he says every songwriter was there: Jimmy Webb, Paul Williams, Van Dyke Parks, George. The list of people was scary, and it was the last day after the big LA earthquake. So we're all sad and sullen, standing around the grave, and George just suddenly goes, "Fuck you." And we were all really shocked. We thought he was having some sort of moment. And then he said, "That was always my favorite song." So we all joined in and sang it.
sang You're Breaking My Heart, back to
You're
the
old. You're Breaking My Heart. Yeah.
So imagine all the rock and roll royalty singing that song at Harry's funeral. It warms the cockles. He was the ultimate Beatles fan. And to go back to Jimmy Webb, there's a quote here. Harry was primarily a Beatles man, the number one Beatles fan in the whole world. Harry would say, I don't know why anybody else makes music. The only people who make any music that's worth listening to are the Beatles. And there'll never be another band like the Beatles. That could be our motto, Stephen. So when Harry got to make records with John and got to be friends with Ringo and sort of got to be, in a way, the fifth Beatle, his life was complete. That was all he ever wanted. He wanted to know those people. He wanted to be admired by them. That's all there was to it. Everything else was small print, like a PS. And that's kind of it, really.
I think that's it.
I don't think Harry Nilsson was ever unhappy.
No, I think that sums it up perfectly. He's a man that got to kind of fulfill his dreams. Yeah. And, you know, what more can we ask for than that?
So, Harry would have been 80 in 2021. He was only 52 when he died. There's many ways to enjoy Harry Nilsson in the 21st century, but probably the most essential bits and pieces we might point people towards are, you know, the RCA albums box is a ridiculously good thing.
It's fantastic. Yeah,
it's fantastic. At the time of recording, it's only 42 Earth pounds on Amazon, and it's 17 CDs worth of Harry Nilsson music, 14 albums plus 3 CDs of sessions, unreleased alternate versions. There's over 100 bonus tracks throughout the entire box with full notes about when they were recorded, who they were recorded with. And it's just a fantastic resource of, you know, it's got Pussycats in there, but you got to take it all together. That's the whole point of Harry. It tells a story.
And I was very happy to own this until you told me how cheap it now is.
But, yeah, it wasn't that cheap when it came out.
It wasn't that cheap when it came out. It's a superb collection. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
17 CDs, 60 or 100 bonus tracks, 40 quid. You can't go wrong. There's if you really are that much of a cheapskate, there's a new Nilsson compilation out this year, which is a 3 CD thing called Nilsson Gold, which is only £6, £6 Earth pounds. Although it's missing perhaps my favorite Nilsson song, which is Turn On Your Radio, which was covered by Eels. Yeah. Few years ago, and which is a wonderful, wonderful song. There was a show I was watching recently called Moonbase 8, and it had Nilsson's Spaceman. He just pops up all the time.
It's kind of random. I was watching something in the Lottery song, which is probably my favorite.
It
popped up on something, and again, I think that's just it's a fantastic little song. It's very inconsequential, but it tells you everything you need to know about him in the lyrics. So.
And his reach still continues. The group Weezer put out a surprise new album in January 2021 called OK Human, and they've said the primary influence for that is the Nilsson Sings Newman album, which is a fantastic Nilsson album from 1970, where he sings the Randy Newman songbook. So it's pretty early in Randy's career as well. And it's a phenomenally good example of Harry's multi-tracking and his studio techniques. It seems like a simple album, but it's not. And Weezer have said that their new album, OK Human, is a direct lift from Nilsson Sings Newman, and I've listened to the Weezer album, and I can see exactly where they're coming from, and I would highly recommend it as a version of seeing how Harry is still affecting us all musically in the 21st century. So he was a good man.
Good man. Do you want to mention the documentary that you mentioned earlier, DVD?
It is out. Well, it's out on DVD, but it's a bit tricky to find, I think. It's called Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? It came out on DVD in 2010, and it's a labor of love by some fans, but they managed to get the clearances necessary and reach. They interview all the key people, except maybe, you know, any Beatles themselves, but they do talk to Eric Idle and Mickey Dolenz and all the other kind of mega Harry Nilsson fans. And it gives a fantastic chronological overview, and it's done with Harry's family in tow as well. So Una, Harry's wife, appears, and she is the star of the show in that documentary.
It really is
worth tracking down. It has never, to my knowledge, appeared on television, so you really have to go looking for it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm trying to think where I saw it. Was it on the DVD, or did it make it onto like an arena show once on BBC Two or something?
I don't know. I mean,
I haven't been able to find it.
somebody I know downloaded it illegally, but I don't know.
Oh, I see. Well, maybe that was it.
But it's very good, worth sticking out.
So we're basically saying Harry Nilsson was the fifth Beatle, and if you like the Beatles, you love Harry Nilsson, and you should just buy all of his records in one go.
We're aware that this is a Beatles podcast, and this hasn't really been an episode particularly about the Beatles, but he's certainly someone who weaves into the tapestry of the Beatles' lives, and if you're a Beatles fan, plugging yourself into Harry Nilsson makes perfect sense, and for 40 quid to buy 90% of his recorded work is a worthwhile use of your money. And so, as usual, whenever we're doing these podcasts, we want to send people back to the music. And if it's Beatle music or Harry Nilsson music, or you know, Harry's versions of Beatles music, he's covered She's Leaving Home, Blackbird, Isolation, all the Beatles tracks he's covered over the years. That's what we want to send you back listening to. But what do you think, everybody? Do you like Pussycats? Do you think it's good? Are you already Nilsson fans? Have we sold you on the Nilsson vibe? Let us know. Get in touch in all the usual places. We are available on Twitter at Beatles Pods, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, where Stephen will let you in, and our website, nothingisrealpod.com, which gives you links to all our social media, all our playlists. I think we'll have to put together a Best of Nilsson playlist for this episode and stick that up there as well. And other ways of getting in touch with us, past episodes, past playlists, everything is on nothingisrealpod.com, so check that out. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.